Okay, everyone, so let us continue where we left off yesterday. So what we have done so far, we've had a look at what I would call kind of overview suttas, suttas which give a kind of bird's eye view, a broad picture of the Dhamma, of the teachings of the Buddha. And now what I want to do is to kind of zoom in on a more specific teaching, which is more to do with the actual practice in detail and this kind of thing. And this particular teaching is called the gradual training. And this gradual training is very useful in many ways. First of all, it is really an expansion of the Noble Eightfold Path. So it takes all the factors of the Noble Eightfold Path and it shows how they work in expanded form and also how they relate to each other. Yeah, so how they kind of flow naturally, starting from right view and going all the way to the end of the path. And this gradual training is simply for that reason, it's obviously very important, the fact that it has relates directly to the Noble Eightfold Path. But it's also important in the sense that it is found, this particular structure is found in so many places in the suttas. As I said before, if something is found in many places, in many, something that was given to many, a teaching given to many different people, with slight variations on the theme and all of these kind of things, then it would have been an important teaching, could have been considered by the Buddha as important. So if you look at the Digha Nikaya, for example, you find the gradual training 12 times in the Digha Nikaya, and the long discourses. You find it about 10 times maybe in the middle length discourses. You also found it in the Anguttara Nikaya, so it is sort of very prominent in the suttas, this particular teaching. And for this reason, it is obviously important. So, the name of the sutta that I have chosen, there are so many versions of it, but one of the versions that I like the most is the one which is called the Shorter Sutta on the Simile of the Elephant's Footprint. And the idea here with the elephant's footprint is like if you go into the jungle and you see a large footprint of an elephant, then you can assume that presumably this is a large elephant because it looks like a large elephant's footprint. But you can't be absolutely sure until you actually see the elephant for yourself. Yeah, and this is a bit like that. It's you practice the path of the Buddha, and as you practice that, you see some of the footprints of the Buddha, some of the things that he must have practiced on the way. And then as you see those footprints, you follow along those footprints, and eventually you come to the point where you see enough of the Dhamma for yourself to actually understand that this must have been the Buddha who practiced this way. That's when you, in a sense, see the Buddha for yourself, when you have the same insight that the Buddha had at that time. So this is the idea behind the simile of the elephant's footprint. It's a long preamble, a long introductory section to the sutta that I have just taken out, because you can't read everything. If you read everything, you're gonna be here for a long, long time. Maybe that's a good idea, shall we? We can expand it, add a few weeks or something. But no, we only have these 9 letters. 9 letters is actually really nice, you know. If you get too much, it also isn't so good, because you need to parse things up and have it in portions and then kind of come back in a year's time or whatever. And this is often the best way of learning these things. So anyway, so here the simile has been spoken by the Buddha, and now comes the practical side of the simile, right? The what actually the simile really refers to. And here the Buddha starts out by saying, "So too, Brahmin, here a Tathagata appears in the world, accomplished, fully enlightened, perfect in true knowledge and conduct, sublime, knower of the world, incomparable leader for persons to be tamed, teacher of gods and humans, awakened and blessed." Yeah, so this is how the Buddha starts out the gradual training. And it's kind of interesting that the gradual training actually starts out with the Tathagata appearing in the world. That's how the gradual training actually commences. Tathagata, of course, being the Buddha again. So without the Tathagata arising in the world, there is no gradual training. Yeah, so in other words, again, it is this idea of Kalyanamitta that we talked about before. You have to have the Kalyanamitta, you have to have the Saparisa, the superior person to be there to teach you these things. And without that, it doesn't even commence. There's nothing you can do because there's nobody who actually sees the truth properly here. And therefore, there's nothing, you can't really follow that path. It doesn't exist without the Buddha arising. Yeah. And that is very interesting because, of course, in later Buddhism, we have the idea of the Bodhisattvas. This is what Mahayana Buddhism is all about. And later Theravada Buddhism is also about Bodhisattvas to a large extent. I think there was a bit of a competition there, right? The Mahayanas have the Bodhisattvas. We have to have it as well. Okay, write it into the commentaries. Can't put it back into the suttas, but we can put it into the commentaries there. So we then had the Theravada Bodhisattva idea as well. And of course, they had to make it slightly different. It couldn't be exactly the same, right? This is what how things work. I think this was Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi's thesis, that there's always this sense of borrowing ideas from different traditions. So the Theravadas may have borrowed the Bodhisattva idea from the Mahayana tradition. And then, of course, they had the 10 paramis, and the Mahayanas had the 6 paramis, and these kind of differences. But the whole point here is really that the whole idea of a bodhisattva is questionable, highly questionable from the early suttas. Why? Because there is no path when there is no Buddha. There is nobody to guide you. There's nobody to show you the way. You don't know what you're doing. You're fumbling around in the dark. So how can you be practicing a path that leads towards awakening here? You can't, basically. And this is what this says right here from at the beginning of the gradual training here. So the whole idea of the bodhisattva path is kind of very dubious when you look at it from early Buddhism. And of course, not only is it dubious from a kind of pragmatic point of view and from a point of view of what the suttas say, but also the very fact that it isn't found in the early suttas, it wasn't taught by the Buddha, it is something that arises later on, also make you question this whole idea of the bodhisattva ideal and the bodhisattva path. There is a very nice book that was written by Venerable Anali. I've been mentioning his name quite a few times now, but he has done a lot of interesting studies. And he is a local, right? He is from he's German, so that's quite nice as well. And he wrote a book called the Origin or the Provenance of the Bodhisattva Ideal, something like that. And it's a very nice book that shows, in my opinion, in a very convincing way, how the Bodhisattva Ideal arose out of the early suttas, especially when the Buddha passed away. People were kind of grieving, oh, the Buddha is gone, what are we going to do now? And then kind of the Bodhisattva ideal arose from that, and from some of the early ideas in the suttas. And then it developed gradually and became a full-fledged ideal over time with its own path and all of these kind of things. But so this is one of those interesting things. There is only a path when the Buddha arises in the world. You have to have that Kalyanamitta. Otherwise, you can't reach awakening. That's what we saw in the previous sutta, right? Starts off with the Saparisa, and then gradually, stage by stage, takes you all the way to awakening from that. So this is the first thing here. Then, of course, this idea, we have a Tathagata appears in the world. Sounds a bit mystical, right? Appears in the world. What does that mean? Kind of suddenly appears out of the blue. Bang, there he is, Tathagata. Is that what it means? It's kind of slightly strange the way it is phrased in English. I'm not sure if it is an ideal translation because it sounds a bit weird. But what it means is that all it means really is that occasionally, if we look at kind of samsaric existence where people kind of live on from life to life and kind of revolve around and kind of the universe expands and contracts and all these kinds of things, occasionally there will be somebody who has the right conditions. For some reason, all the conditions will come together for one particular person. And those conditions will then enable that person to make a breakthrough, to see things according to reality. And those conditions will be internal conditions for that person. They must have somehow, they have happened onto the right kind of qualities with people who have been practicing at least rightly to some extent. And then you have the external conditions coming together, For example, in ancient India, there would have been many other factors required for being an ascetic, for practicing these paths, would have been in place. It was a society that valued ascetics, that valued people practicing religious teachings. It was a society where there was a lot of support for this. It was a society where samadhi was already being practiced. And we know that because when the Buddha started out, when he started out his search, first of all, he went to these teachers, right, Uddaka Ramaputta and Alara Kalama, and he asked them for guidance in the practice, and they were practicing samadhi, and so he learned about samadhi practice. So all these factors were coming together, and all these factors come together, and it's like the gunpowder and the match coming together, bang, you get awakening as a consequence. So that is what it means. So every now and again, there will be somebody who makes that breakthrough to understanding reality according to what it actually is. And this is one other thing that I really like about these Buddhist teachings, that it is not unique that we have a Buddha in the world. Yeah, a Buddha is someone who someone who kind of makes a breakthrough at regular intervals. Every now and again, there will be a Buddha. So we are not kind of some unique time in history, which is kind of completely exceptional, and it has never happened before, it will never happen again. But it's more like a natural principle that arises every now and again. It makes us less unique. It's a bit like, the way science kind of has rolled back many of the religious ideas of the past few centuries, and we have kind of become less and less unique, right? We started off being the center of the universe, and then we became this obscure little planet in an obscure galaxy, far, far away from the central things. And this is just taking that one step further, in a sense, that saying that actually there isn't any one savior as such. Saviors, if you want to call it that, but enlightened people, they arrive at regular intervals. So again, it makes us less special. And it's good to be less special, right? It's good because if you are very special, there's something wrong about that. Why should we be special? We're just ordinary people like everyone else, and we should be expected to be ordinary people. It's much more believable if we are just ordinary people. If we somehow are special, I think there's always a good reason to doubt that actually is reality, because that's just not how things are. Of course, we all like to think that we are special, but we also, at the same time, we realize that we are just people like everyone else. So this is another thing I like about the Buddhist teachings. They kind of appear true to my idea of how the world works. And that is what is so good about them, in my opinion anyway. And then we have this whole sequence of epithets or qualities of the Buddha that come next, starting with accomplished and ending up with blessed. And this here is the famous verse that you see in the suttas, and we haven't chanted it here, but it goes iti piso bhagava arahan samma sambuddho vijja tarana sampanno, etc. And this particular verse, or this particular paragraph that you find throughout the suttas, is the qualities of the Buddha. And not just the qualities of the Buddha, but they are specifically those qualities by which the Buddha explained himself. If you're going to think about the Buddha, if you're going to think about someone who is awakened, this is how you should think about that person. This is what the Buddha says. And if you use this contemplation in the right way, you think about it in the right way, and we'll see this later on again, it should give rise to a sense of gladness, right? Joy, that you have this remarkable teacher who is available to us, who can explain the path all the way to the end of suffering. What an amazing thing that is, to be able to have such a teacher. And then you kind of build up that joy, and that joy then becomes again the basis for your meditation practice, your ability to succeed in samadhi, and all these other kind of things. So this particular passage that we're seeing now is actually very interesting, and it's very important, and it's very useful to think about it and to reflect on it, to draw out some of the implied meanings in this. And the more you understand the implied meanings in this, the more likely it is that you will be able to get something out of it when you reflect on this. And it will be meaningful to you. It will bring joy. It will bring all of these things that it's supposed to bring out. So there you are. So this is why this is interesting. So let's have a look at all of these terms and all of these qualities of the Buddha and see if we can draw out some of the meaning, what is actually meant by these things. So the first one here is accomplished. That is the Pali word arahant. Yeah, I'm sure many of you will have heard the word arahant. The word arahant just means somebody who has reached the end of the path, and somebody who is fully awakened. That is how it is used in the suttas. So here it's translated as accomplished. What it really means, it means somebody who is worthy. That's actually the meaning of this word. So it means like the worthy one. And the word arahant is not one of these words that existed before the time of the Buddha and was used of anyone who was considered a saint, considered someone who's practiced the path all the way to the end. So it was a kind of broad term in this society, taken up by the Buddha and used specifically also for his disciples. So it means somebody who is worthy. In what respect is an arahant worthy? Well, in the respect of being somebody who is a who has seen the reality as it actually is, and then being a teacher for other people. If somebody has seen things according to reality, they're able to teach you something. Not only teach you, but teach you things that are, to do with the very core aspirations of human beings. The things that we're all searching for in one way or another. Satisfaction, sense of completion, a sense of, ending this kind of craving, this itch which is always there, and finding a sense of finality in things. If somebody has the ability to teach you that, of course, they become the supreme teacher, and they are worthy of that respect and, even generosity and all of these other kind of things that any teacher is worthy of if they are a good teacher. But of course, here you have the highest teacher, That is why they become worthy ones in that sense. So just like any teacher is worthy, this is like the highest teacher, if you wish. So that is really the meaning here. Accomplished is fine as a translation, but it has a kind of has a more of a subtle meaning than that. Then we have the idea of fully enlightened again, which is Samma Sambuddha in the Pali language. And again, this idea of awakening, which means insight into reality, seeing especially insight into the human mind, understanding what it means to be a human being or any kind of being. And of course, part of that, seeing the impermanence and non-self, and all of these qualities is part of that. So you have this insight, and the good thing is that if you have insight, you become happy at the same time. Yeah, if you have insight, it doesn't make you miserable, it makes you happy as a consequence. So you end the suffering at the same time, you achieve the highest happiness. And it kind of makes sense. That you, when you have insight, when you see things according to reality, it should make you happy. Because if you don't have insight, if you don't know what is going on, how can you make the right decisions in life? If you think that you're going to go down to the nearest shop and buy some breakfast or whatever, and you don't know where the shop is, you go down the wrong street. Where does it lead? It leads to suffering. It doesn't lead to breakfast, it leads to suffering instead. But if you go down the right street, it leads to breakfast, and it leads to happiness instead. This is kind of the point here. When you see things rightly, it tends, and you practice accordingly, it tends to lead to happiness and away from suffering. And that is true in all kind of spheres of life. Whenever you have the right view of things, it leads you in the right direction. That is an important part of this idea of full awakening. If you understand things correctly, then you are also happy and you have avoided suffering. And of course, the idea of purity, someone who hasn't got any defilements, of course, is also part of this idea of awakening here, what it actually means. And that is an important thing because that also means that there is something to do with your conduct. Your conduct also changes as a consequence of awakening here. And this is the next one here. It says that you are perfect in true knowledge and conduct. True knowledge again is vidya, which we have discussed already in quite a bit of detail, which is like insight. And I was specifically pointing out the three insights, the te vidyas on the Buddhist path, the idea of understanding past lives, understanding the law of karma, and the understanding of the ending of rebirth, of arahantship itself. So these are the three main knowledges in Buddhism that kind of really changes your outlook and makes you look at the world in a different way. What is interesting here, we already discussed that in enough detail, I think, but what is interesting here is that this is combined with conduct. Conduct seems like very kind of, doesn't seem like very much compared to these big insights. But of course the point here is that if you have real insight, if you are changed as a person, if you destroy all the defilements in the mind, it's going to have an effect on your bearing, on your behavior, on how you are. If you have no defilements anymore, if you have no latent anger inside, if you have no greed inside of you, it's going to come out in how you behave. You're going to be peaceful. You're not going to be angry with people. If, you know, whenever, you know, you hear things like, yeah, you know, he's not, you see somebody who is angry, and then, but he's kind of rumored to be an arrogant at the same time. You see, yeah, it's not real anger, right? It's just kind of playing, it's kind of a game or something like that. And I think that is always very dubious when you see that, because the whole point of the path, the Buddhist path, is precisely what Buddha says, well, investigate. Look for these things. Yeah, if somebody does have defilements, and they show defilements, well, that's what you are likely to see. And this is exactly how we can make judgments about people in the world, whether they are worthy of being a teacher or not, is precisely by looking out for these kind of things. In fact, the Buddha encourages us to do that. He says, look at me. In another sutta, the Chankya Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya 95, he says that any teacher should be looked upon in that way. Yeah, and if the Buddha says that, it means that we have the ability, at least to some extent, to recognize the qualities, the mental qualities of somebody. So we shouldn't be afraid of making those kind of judgments. If we are afraid of making those kind of judgments, we're going to fool ourselves as to who really is worthy of respect as a teacher in this world and who is not. The fact that the Buddha says we should do so means that the Buddha is saying, well, you have the ability to do this. It doesn't mean that we should make absolute judgment. This person is really bad. This person is really good or anything like that. But what it means, if we see something that looks like defilements, we should have a little bit of doubt. Yeah. We shouldn't kind of dismiss it as, yeah, it's just kind of, there's a reason for that or whatever. When there is grounds for having doubt, then we should have that. That is the right approach, according to how the Buddha teaches these things. And I think this is very important. One of the things that you recognize when you travel around the Buddhist world a lot, which is one of the things I do these days, is that people are often very fearful of these things. They are afraid, oh, if I criticize an arahant, right, it's going to be bad karma. This is the kind of thing you hear. And especially if you are grown up in a Buddhist society, and you've been told this kind of thing since you were tiny, 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 it has kind of come in with the, you know, with the growing up, and you actually, these things become very difficult to let go after a while. But the reality is actually the opposite, I think. If you read how the Buddha talks about these things in the suttas, it is actually worse to go around protecting somebody who is obviously not a very good person at all, protecting them, pretending that they are what they are not, and then putting other people in the danger of being misled by these people. This is actually more bad karma, the way I read the suttas, than actually being honest and open about somebody, which actually isn't bad karma at all, because you are just kind of being honest about what is there. As long as you do it with a degree of humility and not kind of being too kind of adamant or this kind of thing, but kind of see, there may be a problem here, that sort of thing. That is perfectly acceptable. In fact, it is an important thing to do. There is a nice sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya where the Buddha says that he compares... I think he says that if you speak well about somebody who is not, you praise someone who is not worthy of praise, it is bad. And the good karma is if you dispraise somebody who is worthy of dispraise, and you praise somebody who is worthy of praise, that is where the good karma is. He specifically kind of makes that distinction there. So these things actually are significant. The main point here is that if you have real insight, it will affect your conduct. And because it will affect your conduct, it means that there is an opportunity for us to want to see somebody just from the outside and have some idea about who they are. Yeah, an important thing. Sometimes you hear things like crazy wisdom. Yeah, watch out for crazy wisdom. Right? Usually either crazy or wise. Not both together, usually. That's my experience. The idea of crazy wisdom is the idea that people do crazy things and they are wise at the same time. Usually it doesn't work like that. And usually, if you are wise, it actually does come out in your conduct in a very powerful way. So if you think I'm a bit crazy, it means I don't have much wisdom. Yes, this is how you check it out. This is the vidya and charana, the conduct and knowledge that come out together. And the Buddha, of course, being perfected in this, means that you should see his conduct. It means that you should see almost perfect conduct from somebody like the Buddha. Of course, we have to be careful because sometimes it's, the conduct is also a matter of personality traits as well. So we have to be careful not to kind of confuse personality traits with defilements. But usually we can distinguish those things if we observe carefully. Next quality here of the Buddha is sublime. And the word sublime is a translation of the Pali word sugata. Sugata is one of those words that you see throughout the suttas, being one of the words used for the Buddha almost everywhere. And sugata literally means well gone. That's what it means. So sometimes in the suttas you see sugati and dugati. It means like good destinations and bad destinations. So you've gone to a good destination or gone to a bad destination. Sugati, dugati. And here it means someone who has gone to a good destination in this life. The Buddha obviously isn't going to be reborn, but in this very life he has already arrived at a good destination. So you could say somebody like the happy one, maybe. The sublime one, it says here. The happy one, the one who has arrived at a good destination, is really what it's referring to. So that is the idea behind that. Then we have the idea of knower of the world, right? This is, I think, quite an interesting little description of the Buddha. What does that mean? And of course, in the traditional way that this is understood, it means that you understand the world in terms of the possible types of rebirth, the possible types of karma that leads to those rebirths, and all the kind of combinations of these kind of things. That is probably part of it, or it is definitely part of it. But the main point about knowing the world is to know the range of happiness and suffering that is possible within samsaric existence. And the reason why, of course, this is important from the Buddha's point of view is that the Buddha, you have to decide whether you want to make an end of samsara or not. Is samsara really worthwhile? Is it possible to find a place in samsara, a corner of samsara, where everything is happy? You can just hang out for until eternity and just chill and just have a good time. Is that possible? Is it not possible? Right, these are important questions. So because of that, what knower of the world really comes down to, it comes down to understanding the full scope of suffering and happiness that is available in samsaric existence. And of course, at the same time, whether that happiness, or that suffering for that matter, can be sustained, whether it can be kept going, whether it can be permanent or not. That is really what it is about. And once you have a full overview of all possible happiness and suffering, it means that you have to do a lot of practice to see all of that. You have to kind of reach the highest happiness, right? That's why you have to do all the samadhi practices and all of these kind of things. Once you have a full overview of that, then you can make a decision about what you should be doing, whether this is worthwhile or not, whether this actually is it dukkha or is it sukha? Should I be doing this or not be doing this? Should I get off the wheel or should I not get off the wheel? Is it good to be reborn, bad to be reborn? Is there any permanence, is there no permanence? All of these things kind of become clear once you see that full range of things. And of course, part of seeing that full range of things is also seeing what lies beyond human existence. This is one of those fascinating things that sometimes people find difficult to grasp or to understand or make sense of. Is the idea, from a Buddhist point of view, that you're not just reborn as a human being, but you can be reborn in all these other realms, right? All these other possibilities are also available there for us, if you like it. So how can we make sense of that to actually make it more acceptable or understandable? How can we actually take this on board that we're seeing really weird? How can I become this ghost? Right? A ghost seems so alien to us. Or a deva. How can I be a deva? It's such an alien idea to be something like that. So how do we understand this? And the way that I like to understand it, where I find it very simple and easy to understand, You take human existence, right? In human existence, you have quite a broad range of various ways of existing, from kind of the, you know, on the lower end of the scale, you have people who get reborn in really war-torn countries, and lots of suffering. They lose their parents when they're young. They don't get any education. They starve a lot of the time, and they kind of generally really, really miserable existence in so many ways. And then on the other hand, you have people who kind of get reborn in a wealthy place, they have a good education, they are intelligent, and they have kind of access to the Buddhist teachings, right? Yeah, that's an important one. And so you have all of this, so you have quite a wide spectrum in human existence. It's already between the most impoverished and poor person and the most suffering people to the people who are on the other end of the scale. So the way to think about other rebirths is just to expand that scale out. That scale doesn't end with the most kind of the most miserable people in the world. It goes way below that. It gets much worse. And on the upside, it gets much, much better as well. You can get reborn in different realms. It gets far, far better than just being, you know, reborn as a in a very good circumstances on this planet. So that is how to understand that. And when you do get reborn in one of these other destinations, it's like me, I'm there, yeah. Suddenly you're just a ghost. Okay, here I am. I'm a ghost now. Okay, what's going on? Okay. And then you kind of find your way in the ghost realm, and you kind of figure out how to deal with the ghost realm. Or more likely, right, because of the kind of company we have here, much more likely you're going to be reborn in the Deva realm, yeah? So you come, you get, one day you die, and suddenly, wow, what's going on now? Different, yeah? Deva Loka, wow, this is pretty cool. And then you kind of, you hang out for a while, you enjoy yourself for a while, because enjoyment is so great in Deva Loka, and you think, wait a minute, this is not really, doesn't have any purpose. Then you go to the Buddhist Devas, and you go to them and say, oh, please teach the Dhamma, right? And then you recognize the Dhamma again, and then you kind of continue practicing the Dhamma, the Buddhism in the Devaloka. That's pretty nice, isn't it? Because the Buddha was teacher of gods and humans. That's coming up next, by the way. Teacher of gods and humans. So you go to the Devaloka, you both have a good time, and you practice the Dhamma. Whoa, best of both worlds. Something like that, anyway. The idea of knower of the world, and only when the Buddha had that full scope, the full understanding of the limits of happiness and suffering, whether it could be attained permanently or not, was he able to then make a decision, right? Should I make an end of this or not? And this is the wisdom of the Buddha, if you like. This broad part of that wisdom, the broad, full understanding of the limits and the scopes of happiness and suffering in the world. And then, of course, you can make these kind of profound decisions about things. Then we have the idea, the next one, of he is the incomparable leader of persons to be tamed. I always like this to be tamed part at the end. So one of the ways I'd like to try to look at incomparable leaders of tameable people or tameable persons. So, you know, only people who are tameable can be tamed, obviously. This is what does it mean to be tameable? And what it means basically is that you kind of have to take an interest in the Buddhist teachings. You have to kind of find them attractive. You have to want to practice them. If you say our Buddhism is all nonsense, of course there's no chance of you kind of going down this path. And so you become untameable. Yeah. And what does it mean to be tamed? And what it means really is just the abandoning of the defilements. The defilements that make us wild. The defilements that make us agitated and restless and always moving around. As I mentioned the other day, you know, the idea in the Siddha that we are the slave of craving. Craving is the slave driver, whipping us over the back, saying, go here, go there. And you say, yes, master, here. And you run after it, and craving is in charge. And you're just kind of this puppet, you know, being run by craving in this way. And this is the problem. So this is why we're not tamed, right? Because we are not really in charge of ourselves. There are these forces in our mind that are in charge. And we're not able to do what we really want. We're not able to sit still on the meditation cushion, right? Every one of us have had an experience sometimes. Oh, I don't want to sit here anymore. I've had enough of this meditation. Oh, I want to go back home, please. Right, not four more days. Oh no, this is terrible. sometimes these thoughts happen, right? Because sometimes you've had enough, because it's a different way of doing things and all these kinds of things. And of course, that means that we're not really in charge of ourselves. If we were in charge, we were able to say, okay, I'm going to be here, and I'm going to bliss out for 9 days. But of course, we can't just do that just like that. We have to go through the training. We have to tame ourselves to get to that point. So the Buddha is the incomparable leader of these people who are tameable. And why is that? Well, obviously it is because he has seen the Noble Eightfold Path. He has understood the path and actually lead to this point. So that's obviously why he is incomparable. Nobody else had seen that when the Buddha arose in the world. So he has the insight, he has the knowledge, he knows that, when he reaches the full awakening experience, he knows that he has found that key that everyone is looking for, the key to real happiness, the key to real contentment, the key to real satisfaction, the thing that craving always promises you, but never actually delivers. He has found that, And because he has found the key, he has found the key to the meaning of life and all of these kind of things, and he's aware of that. He knows that he has an incredibly valuable gift to give to all people. And of course, this is the Buddha's wisdom side. He is aware of that. He has this extraordinary gift to give to other people. And because he knows he has this gift, he has the highest gift that anyone can possibly give to anyone else. What that means is that compassion arises, and the will, the motivation to do something about it also arises at the same time. So the Buddha has the wisdom and he has the compassion. And these two things, in a sense, to the highest quality, precisely because he has the highest insight into this phenomenon. And what is powerful about the compassion of the Buddha, the vast majority of teachers in the world, in whatever realm they might be teaching, in whatever subject they're teaching, or whether it's religious or non-religious or secular, or whatever it is, the vast majority of teachers in the world, they have some kind of vested interest in teaching. You teach because it brings you a salary. You teach because you like to have many disciples. You teach because of you become famous. You teach because you need to feed your children, or whatever it is, right? There's all these reasons for being a teacher in the world. But for the Buddha, and this is kind of an interesting point, there is no vested interest. There's nothing that he gains from teaching. In fact, for the Buddha, there is a negative vested interest. It's a hassle for him. Right? The Buddha, he could just kind of go to a cave somewhere, sit back, chill out, relax, go into the jhanas, bliss out all the time. Instead, he has to teach us. Imagine the difference there is quite large for a Buddha, for somebody who's fully awakened like that, between the kind of the all the problems that are involved in teaching people, arguing back, right? But listen, I've seen reality. Why are you arguing back? This is what it's like. But I don't believe what you're saying. Explain yourself properly. And, it's always like that, right? He has a negative vested interest in teaching. For him, it's actually more like a hassle than it is anything that he gets out of it. And this is kind of what is so interesting. So it means that the Buddha's compassion, the Buddha's kindness in giving us these teachings is completely pure. There's nothing impure there. There's no self in there which kind of gains anything out of it. And this is what is so beautiful about this. And when you think about the teachings like that, when you remember that, when you read the suttas, that they come from that kind of purity, you can kind of take them on board in a very different way. Because you know that they are given only out of compassion for each one of us. Only out of kindness to help us out of suffering and to move us towards happiness. That's the only reason why they are given. There is no other interest in there whatsoever. Except perhaps if they have been a little bit distorted over the centuries. But these are the things that we can sort out by comparative study and these kind of things. So when you read the suttas, every word very often has a very specific meaning here. Every word is something that needs to be contemplated. Every word is spoken out of compassion and kindness for all the students of the Buddha. And when you read the text like that, you take it on board in a very different way. And even if there is a passage that you may not understand, or you think, oh, the Buddha is asking too much, I don't want to do that. All these rules, 227 rules for monks, 311 rules for the nuns, right? Even more rules. And you think, oh no, so many rules, I can't even remember half of these rules, right? And they weren't actually monks like that. Oh, the Buddha's asking too much. He's kind of, this is actually in the Vinaya Pitaka, you find these kind of things there. It's quite amusing when you read about this. People haven't changed, right? People are exactly the same. We're exactly the same then as they are now. That's what you find when you read the Vinaya Pitaka. The point here is that you look at these suttas in a different way. And if you can't take it on board, you find the sutta is too profound or you can't make any sense of it, you say, at the very least, you say, okay, I'll put it aside for now, but I'm not going to reject it out of hand because you value this teaching so highly. But you don't also, you don't force yourself to accept something you can't accept. That's also a silly thing to do. Because if you do that, you build up some kind of eternal resistance. So if you can't accept something, fair enough. You put it to one side. But you try to kind of then come back to it later on, and maybe you have a different view of those teachings at a later stage. So you allow it to grow, you allow it to become like more natural for you. So this is the Buddha being the incomparable leader of persons to be tamed. And remember what I'm saying now, this is just what I take out of these particular things, and of course I have contemplated these things a few times, so that's why I have a few things to say about this, but of course there are different ways of looking at these things, and everybody can get different things out of these particular qualities here and descriptions. And often you need to contemplate in your way and kind of get your feelings out of these things because we're all slightly different. We want to take out the different lessons from these particular qualities. The lessons that speak to me may not be the lessons that speak to you. So we kind of take out different things out of these things. So please remember that. This is not kind of, I'm not telling you the absolute final truth, right? These are just kind of ideas for how to think about these things. So then we have a teacher of gods and humans, which is the next one here. And so the Buddha taught gods and humans, and as somebody pointed out the other day, he didn't teach the animals and the ghosts. So this is a problem with being reborn in those realms. So stick to the god realm and the human realm, and then you'll be on the right track. So what is the point of this? Why does it say gods and humans? Why are gods kind of included? We are all humans. We don't really need to know so much about the gods. So why are they included here? And one of the answers, of course, is to point out that just because there might be gods around, doesn't mean that those gods have any insight or any understanding in things. Yes, there might be a god, and these different gods may be very dazzling, and they may seem very powerful, they may seem very amazing, and all these kind of things. Just because they seem amazing doesn't mean they have any real understanding. Yeah, just like when you see a king, you know, flying around in his, you know, some of his really wealthy people that fly around in the private jumbo jet and this kind of stuff. It looks very dazzling, but we don't kind of assume that they have any wisdom, right, just because of that. Actually, sometimes we think the opposite when you see that. So you have this, you know, and the same thing with the Devaloka. Just being that are reborn in a very happy state, it doesn't mean that they kind of deserve any special respect just because of that. And there's a nice little sutta which kind of makes this point in a very nice way. And this is the Sakkapanya Sutta found in the Digha Nikaya, Digha Nikaya number 21, I think it is. Something like that, 21? Yeah, anyway, roughly 21. The questions of Sakka, and Sakka is the name for the Lord, the kind of supreme God of the Tavatimsa heaven, the heaven of 33, which is like two heavens up from kind of humanity, right? So this is kind of how it's traditionally looked upon, the idea of heavenly worlds in Buddhism. So he is the ruler of this realm. He's called Dev Inda, the Lord of the Gods. Lord of the Gods is called that. And of course, he comes down to the Buddha, and when he comes down to the Buddha, there's this enormous light, right, which lights up the whole place. And he approaches the Buddha. Actually, first of all, before, this is a very interesting little story, because it's kind of really weird story. And this is the story of how Sakya actually does approach the Buddha. Because Sakya is a bit shy. Yeah, here is the Lord of the Gods, right? And he's a bit shy. It's kind of sweet, right? The Lord of the Gods is a bit shy because he honors the Buddha, he kind of respects the Buddha so much. So he decides that instead of going straight down to the Buddha, he's going to send like a messenger here. And this messenger that he sends to down to the Buddha is a Gandhava. A Gandhava is a heavenly musician here. Right? So he sends this heavenly musician down to the Buddha. And then he says, well, you know, please, Gandhava, you know, go down and kind of get the attention of the Buddha so that, you know, ask if I can kind of approach and ask a few questions and all this kind of stuff. So Gandhava goes down to the Buddha. And then the way that he gets the attention of the Buddha is very interesting, because what he does, he has a lute, right? Lute, like a little kind of a string instrument. Yeah? He starts playing his lute. And then as he plays his lute, he starts singing it. And what he sings is a love song, right? So he sings a love song to the Buddha. And he says things like, one of the things he says in there is like, I love this maiden, this kind of this young woman, right? I love this young woman just as much as the arahants love the Dhamma. This is the kind of song, right? It's very, very strange. So he goes to the Buddha and sings a love song. And then the Buddha, it's strange. You couldn't have made up anything more strange. It's very kind of, very weird. And then the Buddha comes out and he kind of praises the Gandhava. Oh, very nice song that you have kind of sung there, right? And it's so strange that you almost think it must be real, because nobody would dare to kind of invent this kind of stuff, right? It sounds almost like it's blasphemy towards the Buddha or something when you do that. So this is kind of the background story. I'm not going to... So it goes on for quite a while. But eventually Sakka comes. And Sakka says, oh, thank you for giving me the opportunity to see the Buddha. So Sakka goes to see the Buddha. And then there's a long, nice sutta, actually, about all the kind of conversation between Sakka and the Buddha, very profound. And I think there is a small passage from that sutta later on in here. But what happens before they have the conversation, the Buddha asks Sakka, is it true, Sakka, that you visited all these other spiritual teachers before you have come to visit me? And Sakka says, yes. And the Buddha said, well, what happened when you visited all these other spiritual teachers? And Sakka says, well, when I visited all these other spiritual teachers, I went down to them and I wanted to ask them a question, right, about spiritual life and how to live properly and all these things. But before I had a chance to ask them a question, as soon as these spiritual teachers saw me, because what they saw was this light, this incredibly powerful, this incredibly amazing thing. As soon as they saw me, they all came forward and they wanted to become my disciples. Yeah. I was looking for a teacher and they all wanted to become my disciples. And this kind of shows you how easily it is, and how easily, as you know, as humans or anyone, how easy it is to be dazzled, and how easy it is to be kind of taken in by things that actually are superficial. Yeah, a great light. The reason why we are amazed by that is because we don't normally see this kind of great light. So when we see it, we think that this must be something very special and astonishing. But actually, we don't really know what it is. And then we get it all wrong. And then because of that, we are, we go down the wrong path. And this is what the reason behind this is, the idea that the Buddha is teacher of gods and humans. Is the idea that in ancient India, people had a lot of these gods. Just like you go to India today, everyone has their own god, right? Some of these gods are really frightening when you see them. I don't know if you've seen some of these Indian gods, like, you know, Kali and these kind of gods, you know, the gods with the fangs and blood dripping off them, those kind of things. But anyway, so they have all these gods. And of course, the point here, the Buddha says that actually, just because they are gods, maybe they do exist, doesn't mean they have any particular insight. The Buddha is kind of here creating a hierarchy in the world, yeah? And kind of, it's almost like he's subsuming this other religion within his own and saying, well, actually, you know, these all kind of belong under here somewhere. So this is part of the idea here. Another interesting thing with this, of course, is that one of the things that we often hear as Buddhists, and I know many Buddhists go around saying this, and I'm not sure exactly where it comes from, but this idea that, oh, I'm going to try to be reborn as a human in my next life, because it is in the human realm that is the best place to practice the Dhamma. But actually, you don't find that anywhere in the early suttas. This must be some kind of later development. It may be the case that human realm is particularly good. It may be the case, but the Buddha doesn't actually say that. And what he says right here is that he is teacher of gods and humans. So even if you do go to a heavenly realm, it is, according to this, impossible to practice the Dhamma there. And there are instances in the suttas of devas who become stream entrants of these kind of things, yeah? So it's possible even in those realms to practice the Dhamma. I think this idea that we should try to be reborn as human, I think it is slightly overdone, and there isn't really any real evidence for that, at least from the word of the Buddha, which I think is interesting here. And also I think that often if we try to kind of guide ourselves in a certain direction, yeah, I'm going to make myself get reborn as a human being, yeah, we tend to mess it up. We don't really know what we're doing. Yeah, okay, I want to be a human being, and you're going to get it all wrong, and then it doesn't work out. Very often I think it's much more pragmatic and much better just to allow karma to take its own course. Make sure you live your life well, and then relax as you die. Just enjoy the death process and allow karma to take its course. And then you assume that you will go to the right destination on that basis because you are prepared for that. Okay, so that is the teacher of gods and humans. One of the things that I was saying the other day, which I think I can maybe just remind you again of now as well, is the idea that, of course, sometimes we think the Buddha seems so distant, he seems so far away, both in time and also in culture. How can we relate to the Buddha as a teacher? And, of course, one of the important points here is this idea that when the Buddha spoke these suttas 2,500 years ago, he had people like us in mind. Yeah. He knew that the Dhamma would keep on going in the world for a long time, going from one culture to another culture, from one generation to the next generation. And because he knew that, he, in a sense, he had us in mind. Yeah, and this is so powerful when you read the suttas. Remember that the Buddha, in a sense, was thinking of you when he was giving these teachings. Yeah, because he was thinking of all humanity. If you are part of humanity, he was thinking of you and me and each one of us. And that makes this teaching much more come alive in a very different way when you take the Buddha as your direct teacher in that way. It makes them more powerful. It really, really makes you feel that you are in the presence of the Buddha when you read these teachings. And of course, that is very can be emotionally very, very useful because emotions are a very important part of this. When you draw your emotions in, of course, that makes these things much more powerful as a consequence. So, teacher of gods and humans, one of the important things that I haven't mentioned, one of the interesting things about this entire list, we only have two more qualities to go, and those qualities are fairly minor, but one of the interesting things about this list that I didn't mention is that if you look at all of those qualities, there is nothing there about supernormal powers or anything like that. There's nothing there about the Buddha flying through the air and reading the minds of others and this kind of stuff. It is all about practical, pragmatic things, about wisdom, insight, and also about being the teacher because of that insight. This is the main purpose of these qualities. It's the wisdom faculty and the ability to be a teacher on that basis. Yeah, which is very interesting because if you look at the Buddhist world today, you see that a lot of Buddhists, what they are really interested in is supernormal powers. Yeah, I want to see someone fly through the air. I want to see, and they tell all the stories about monks who apparently have had, maybe nuns as well, maybe even lay people, I don't know, but usually it's about monks. They have these stories about monks who do these enormously crazy things like walking on water and traveling through the air. And it's always stories, and nobody's ever actually seen them themselves. It's always somebody else who's seen it, who's never happens to be there at the time. But I'm being a bit cynical. Please forgive me for that. But this is what people are often interested in. But the problem, of course, is that if you see somebody who does the psychic power, it will be pretty impressive. I have to admit, if you see somebody rise up in the air or walk through the wall or something like that, it would be pretty amazing. But it wouldn't take long before it would just be, so what, right? You would shrug your shoulders, okay, a bit of entertainment, but nothing really more. And this is getting a bit sidetracked, but I remember there was one Adam Ramshaw made this video of an English magician. His name was Dynamo. I don't know if those who are English ever heard about Dynamo. He's a famous magician in the UK. And he did all these astonishing things that were really amazing here. And one of them, there's a video on YouTube if you want to look it up. You can say, Google is on Dynamo walking on water, right? And you see this man, right? And he just standing on the banks of the River Thames in the middle of London, and just under one of the big bridges, I think Waterloo Bridge or something like that. And you see all these people kind of amassing the Waterloo Bridge, staring at this man, right? And as they're staring at him, he kind of steps off the bank and steps onto the water. And he walks onto the water, right? And he walks out. And these people can't believe it. You see people kind of, look, you know, look what's going on. And that is, it's interesting because you can see people are really, really fascinated by this kind of, by this thing. But of course, this is a magician. He's just doing a trick. And how does, and once you know how he does that trick, because he actually revealed it later on, it's kind of so silly and it's so stupid. Because what he did, apparently, he had some kind of plexiglass or something that he put on the surface of the water, and he just walks on the plexiglass. Yeah, that's how simple it was. But everybody is like, wow, look at this, Jesus is coming back. Yeah, look at this. This is pretty much what it was like. And this is fascinating because this actually reflects what the Buddha was saying about psychic powers. Even though the vast majority of Buddhists around the world are so fascinated by these things, what is interesting, of course, is what the Buddha had to say about these things. And what the Buddha says is that he detests, he abhors, he is disgusted. He uses the word disgust. Jiguchi is the Pali word. He is disgusted by psychic powers. Yeah, this is what he says. This is found in, if you want to check it out, in the Kivada Sutta, Digha Nikaya 11, at the beginning of that sutta. This is exactly what he says. And why does he say that? And the reason is, the context is the Buddha is traveling to a certain town, and the people in the town say, oh, please, you know, do some psychic powers. You want to see some psychic powers. If we see psychic powers, we will have even more faith, right? You want to see the monks and everyone do psychic powers. And then the Buddha replies with those exact words, I detest, I abhor, I'm disgusted by psychic powers. Why is that? And he says that, well, those people who already have faith, they will say, hooray, look, yeah, we knew this was true. But those people who don't have faith, they will say, yeah, it's just a magic, it's just a magic trick, right? It's just a dynamo walking on the River Thames, that's really all it is. Yeah, and of course, that is exactly what people will say. People will realize that, will think that it is a magic trick. Those people who don't have faith, they will not increase their faith just because of some kind of show, some kind of entertainment, which is interesting in that only as far as it goes. And so this is the Buddha's attitude to this. And for the Buddha, the real miracle for the Buddha is, of course, the miracle of instruction. The Anusasana Patihariya, it is called in the suttas. The miracle of instruction, whereby you have the insight yourself, you pass on the teachings, come from that insight, and then other people realize exactly the same thing as a consequence of that teaching. That is called the miracle of instruction. When you read the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, at the very end, the Buddha says, wow, Anyakandanya has understood, Anyakandanya has understood. You can see the Buddha is astonished almost that somebody actually has realized that teaching that he proclaimed to them. That is a real miracle in Buddhism. So, it's bad, isn't it? I'm really kind of taking out all the fun, right, in Buddhist teaching, right? No miracles, no supernal powers. I apologize for that because it's kind of a bit of a letdown sometimes. But it's fascinating how the Buddha is so pragmatic. He focuses on those issues that actually matter, those issues that really bring us to the end of suffering. And all of these side things are kind of not important at all. Let's just look at the last two qualities very quickly, because so we can finish off at least one sentence, which is useful. So enlightened, of course, is Buddho again. So usually I like to translate that as awakened, because that's what literally what it means. And the last one is Bhagavan, blessed. And Bhagava is this ancient Indian word that anyone in India will know straight away. And it means like Lord. Yeah, Bhagava, all the gods, they're called Bhagava. So the gods that you pray to and all these kind of things, these are Bhagavas. And of course, Bhagava is also used for some of the greatest spiritual teachers. Whether they really are great or they are just scallywags, that's a different story. But they are used, they're called Bhagavas, like Bhagava Sri Rajneesh, right? Osho, you know, Osho, he called himself Bhagava. And he was the one who said, what did he say? He said that, I'm so detached, I'm not even attached to detachment. And right, I'm so detached, not even attached to detachment. And that's, you know, that's how we explained how we could have so many Rolls Royces and all that kind of stuff. So that was the explanation he had. So anyway, so that is the kind of the ancient Indian word for like a lord or some kind of spiritual guru. They call themselves Bhagavata, and they still do so to the present day in places like India. And because the Buddha, of course, was revered as one of these teachers, he was called precisely that. Okay, so that is all for this morning. So this afternoon, 2:30 this afternoon, we'll spend it all. Yeah.
This afternoon session is half an hour earlier, so it's 2:30, and I'll ring the gong at 2:20. And we also don't have any interviews this afternoon.